MacCast, Monday, January 16th, 2012. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Getting ready to dive into all things Apple Macintosh. That's kind of what we do on this show each and every week. I'm glad to have you hanging out with me for a little bit. Lots of stuff to get into this week. A lot surrounding Apple's big announcement coming up on Thursday. Also, some of the latest rumors and stuff coming out on the iPad 3. And information about how Apple has done with Mac sales. We're kind of gearing up in a couple weeks. We've got Apple's first quarterly results call, and a lot of analysts are expecting that to be pretty positive for Apple. So we're going to get into all of that and a whole lot more. But before we get started on that, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show's sponsors, Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You know, I've told you a lot about Notebook, particularly this time of year. I'm getting ready for my taxes. I know it's horrible to talk about. I hate talking about it, but it's something that I do need to do. And I'll start kind of gathering documents and stuff together, getting together receipts and just taking notes on all the information that I need to bring to my tax professional. And I just create a notebook for doing that with the Circus Ponies. And what I love about it is I can combine all of these documents. So I'm pretty much paperless on most of my stuff. I use a SnapScan or ScanSnap scanner from Fujitsu. I have all my documents in there, and I can just simply drag PDFs right into Notebook, assemble that along with my notes. I can flag little items that I maybe need to do more research on. I can make to-do lists in there, all in a single notebook, and Circus Ponies makes it really quick and easy to do. And it's just a great application for that kind of stuff. It's a great application for taking notes, for doing trip planning, for doing all kinds of different things, because it really just mimics that physical notebook all the way down to the different types of papers. You know, you can control the types of papers, the type of bindings you have in there, play around with cover, do all kinds of neat little tricks. And they have information. If you need to get up and running quickly with the product, they have great tutorials and information on their website, video tutorials done by Don McAllister of Screencast Online fame. And you can check that all out as well as get free trials over on their website, circusponies.com. Head over and take a look, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So let's start off with a little bit of Mac OS X. It seems like less and less these days we're talking about Mac stuff, but we did get some Mac news this week. The latest build of Lion 10.7.3, the next update that's in development, that was released out to developers. They are testing it right now. Rumors are that this build could be the Gold Master or something very close to it. So Apple's maybe getting ready to release an OS X update for us Lion owners, which is something I would appreciate it. I've got, you know, it's kind of buggy, to be honest. I've had some issues with my Lion. I've even considered reinstalling it. And I know some of you have been having issues as well. So hopefully they've squashed a lot of bugs in there. Developers were asked to test the address book, iCal, Mail, Spotlight, and Safari. Specifically, they also apparently in the release notes noted three main fixes in the documentation, calling out a fix for logging in with smart cards. I know that was something that was kind of a big deal for government users of OS X, the ability to log in using a smart card like an RFID card and a reader. So there was an issue related to that. Also, authenticating with directory services and compatibility with Windows file sharing. So looks like there's more than one enterprise-related update in OS X Lion 10.7.3. And then for those of you who are maybe hoping for an update to the Mac Pros, a little bit of speculation that Lion 10.7.3 might be gearing up for a possible Mac Pro update, that it contains some additional drivers for a maybe next generation Mac Pro. So that's good news if that's really there. And then also potential support for ultra sharp MacBook Pro displays. I'm assuming that means the Retina MacBook Pro displays we've been hearing about. A lot of people expecting Apple to rev the notebook line with that high density, high pixel density display, which should look really nice. And I guess there's some things related to that potentially in 10.7.3. So no official word on when it will be out, but sounding like it's going to be soon. So stay tuned for that one. Some recent numbers came out from Gartner, and they show that Apple now ranks as the third largest PC manufacturer in the U.S., at least according to market share in the fourth quarter. They now represent about 11.6% of all PC sales in the States. And Apple was actually the only major PC maker to see a positive year-over-year growth in market share. They're actually up almost 21%. Overall, the report notes that the PC industry was down as a whole. They saw about a 6% decline in their year-over-year market share. And so what's happening to PC market share? Where are those sales going? Could potentially be tablets and smartphones, at least in part, that are eating into it. I would imagine the economy is also a factor. People are probably not upgrading their PCs as frequently, but I think things like the iPad are helping carry people along, and a lot of people are finding that the iPad serves, depending on their needs, as a replacement for a PC. And the numbers seem to support that. The fourth quarter sales, if you remember, of the iPad for Apple, if you tied that into counting as a PC, that almost allowed Apple to tie HP to become the top PC maker in the U.S. Now analysts are saying, looking at the first quarter numbers, that iPad sales are looking to average around 14 million. That's where the predictions are falling. And Mac sales for the first quarter should come in around 5 million. So again, if you count the iPad as a PC, and more people are starting to count tablets and along with Ultra Notebooks and things like that, those are all being lumped into that PC category. If you put all that together and look at how Apple is projected to do for the first quarter, Apple could account for 17.6% of the global PC market, and that would rank them higher than HP, taking them to the number one PC maker in the world, with HP coming in the second place spot at 13%. So no doubt that Apple has set out what it intended to do, which is become the dominant player and really creating the post-PC marketplace. And they are winning the game at this point. And CES was an interesting thing. That happened last week. And it seems like a lot of Apple's competitors have shifted away from trying to compete in the tablet space. We didn't hear a whole lot about new tablets there. I think in 2010, there were about 100 new tablets announced. A lot of those never ever made it to market. This year, you didn't see a lot of that. You saw some Windows tablets, a lot of people shifting from Android, apparently, and Honeycomb over to looking at Windows 8 and building tablets for that platform, although we're getting some early reports that pricing on Windows tablets is going to be more toward the price range that Apple has their devices, between that $600 and $900 price point. So they're going to have to really compete on features as opposed to competing on price, which is what had been happening with a lot of the Android tablets. And now I think that you have the Kindle in the market. A lot of the tablet manufacturers are thinking that they're not going to be able to compete in that space. And they're moving on. And the thing they're moving on to is the Ultra Notebooks. Everybody trying to compete with Apple on the Ultra Slim Solid State Drive Notebooks, competing with the MacBook Airs. And that's another area where Apple has a little bit of a lead. Although I have a feeling PC manufacturers are going to catch up a little more quickly there and going to be able to drive prices maybe a little bit more competitively than Apple. But that might benefit us in the long run. Although, frankly, the MacBook Airs are pretty competitively priced already, so I don't expect them to come down too much, but we might see $100, $150, $200 price drops in that arena when some of these new competitors start hitting the market. So good news for us. Good news for Apple is they are, you know, raking in the dough and gaining market share in the PC space, and that can only benefit us in the long run with better products and, you know, a strong Apple to support us. And one of the ways that Apple is going to continue to lead in the tablet space is with the next generation iPad 3. We've talked a lot about the expected features and functionality. This week, we heard a little more details, specifically on the GPU side. That was something that hasn't been discussed too much, but Imagination Technologies was at CES, and they were showing off some of their latest processors. The PowerVR G6200 and 6400 are expected to be the next generation chips in their PowerVR Series 6 line. And the company claims that the new chips are up to 20 times faster in terms of performance and about 5 times more efficient. So you're going to get better power, longer battery life, and a lot more horsepower. 20 times the performance, or up to 20 times the performance, is still pretty significant. I would think if you got half of that, it would be a big boost over the iPad 2. And seeing as Apple is a major shareholder in Imagination, it's assumed that we could see those new graphics technologies making their way into the iPad 3 alongside that quad-core A6 processor. So, you know, the iPad 3 is probably going to be a screaming beast when it comes to performance. And you couple that with the new display, the Retina display, which is still expected to be that XQGA 2048 by 1536 display. That's going to be a killer tablet. Now, the one thing additional we heard is, I think reported last time, it was expected that Apple was going to have three panel suppliers, Sharp, Samsung, and LG. It sounds like now that Sharp may be out, at least according to one report. They say that Sharp failed to deliver on the initial test shipments of their panels, and so Apple's going to simply go with Samsung and LG as the main suppliers. Both of those companies are reportedly in full production on displays for the iPad 3, and they're estimated to be shipping about 6 to 7 million panels in this quarter. So Apple is definitely ramping up, getting ready for pretty strong demand, and trying to get the supply chain in order. It's expected that both Foxconn and Pegatron are going to be handling the assembly, and parts are being shipped to both those manufacturers probably as we speak. And one of the reasons I think that Apple has been able to get really strong sales and can continue to grow market share is I think they addressed a problem that I always felt they had back when they were suffering from market share or having a hard time gaining market share. And that was just in getting the product out to people, getting good information out to people, and specifically in the retail channel. You know, you couldn't just walk into a store necessarily and buy an Apple product depending on the market you were in. You know, if you were in a big market like myself here in San Diego, we had a lot of great local Apple resellers. We still have Crywolf Computers, which is great Apple reseller here in San Diego, and actually my preferred store to go to because you get really great personal service. But a lot of parts of the country, a lot of places didn't have the kind of market to support that kind of store. And so Apple launching their retail stores has really done a lot to get them in high traffic, high volume malls and places and get a lot of visibility, a lot of marketing support, and they're going to continue to expand that. They'd already done the deal with Best Buy where they have the store within the store that kind of reaches some of the markets where maybe Apple feels they can't have full Apple retail stores, but gives you a place where you can walk in and get hands-on with the Apple products and you can really see what they're all about. Well, this week they announced a similar program with Target. They're going to pilot Apple Store within a stores in 25 Target stores. It's actually part of a larger program that Target's working on that they're calling the Shops at Target. They're going to start with 5 different specialty store within a stores that they're going to put into Target locations in May. The Candy Store, Cost Bar, Polka Dog Bakery, Privet House, and Webster are the first 5, and then Apple is going to be included in that program at some point. They didn't give a lot of details on when and where the 25 Apple pop-up stores would appear, but according to Apple Insider, they do say it's going to be at locations where Apple really feels they can't have a space where they can support an official Apple store. So that's going to be great for some of those smaller regional markets. I wish the program was a little bit bigger. 25 stores isn't that many. Hopefully it's successful enough that Apple continues to roll it out and expand it. I'm trying hard to remember how the Best Buy rollout went, but Apple, I think, started small on that as well, and then it ramped up very, very quickly. And of course, that's exactly what they did with their own retail stores. So I have a feeling it's going to be very successful and expand rather rapidly. And you can expect to see an Apple store probably in your regional Target. I would imagine by the end of the year, next year, or something like that. Now, this next story was something that was sent in by a listener in the UK, and I just thought it was kind of a fun little story and a little twist on the whole Find My iPhone, Find My iPad thing. Apparently, there was a guy who was shopping in a Tesco store in Sussex, in the Sussex area, and he left behind his iPad. Of course, he went back to try and find it, and it wasn't there. He figured it was lost for good. Went home, and a few days later, he suddenly noticed on his iPhone that there were some images showing up in his iCloud photo stream. He had activated photo stream on the iPad, activated photo stream on his iPhone, and suddenly he had these pictures. There was a picture of a dog and some pink suitcases, and then some guy in a knit cap, and it's assumed that the guy in the knit cap was an acquaintance of the person who had actually picked up, they're not saying stole his iPad. I think that's rather kind, actually. The person who had found his iPad and just bothered not to return it, I guess that's how you say that. But anyway, they started taking pictures with it. And it's funny that they didn't undo his iCloud account. You know, you can get your own iCloud account for free, but I guess, you know, thieves and criminals, they're not too smart all the time. Although they were smart enough, apparently, to turn off the GPS, because he did try and check the images for evidence to find out if he could get some location on them, but GPS had been disabled. So they at least knew to go into the location services and turn off that feature. It sounds like, unfortunately, that means he's not going to actually be able to recover the iPad, at least not very easily, through PhotoStream. But it does make me wonder, how long is it going to be before we do find somebody who recovers their stolen iOS device using the PhotoStream service rather than the Find My iPhone feature that Apple has in there, which is specifically for that. It also did make me wonder in this story why Find My iPhone wasn't turned on if iCloud was turned on, because that is another free feature. And I'm encouraging everybody I know who has an iOS device, sign up for a free iCloud account, and if you don't use anything else, use the Find My iPhone feature, because I've just heard so many stories, and I've had friends who've actually been able to locate and recover their devices. Not stolen, but just, you know, they left it somewhere, they couldn't remember where it was, and they were able to go back and find it. And you're also able to confirm, hey, yeah, okay, I left it at the grocery store, it's still at the grocery store, I know I can go back and get it. So it's a nice, handy feature, and it's easy enough to turn on, and it's free. So go ahead and take advantage of that. But interesting story out of the UK this week. And then the big news item for this week, or the big buildup for this week, is Apple's education event. This was something that was rumored a couple weeks ago. It's now been confirmed by Apple, or was confirmed last week by Apple. They're going to be doing an event at the Guggenheim in New York City on Thursday the 19th. It's expected to be an announcement related to textbooks and education. Well, Apple pretty much said it's related to education, but most of the speculation is that Apple's going to do something in the area of textbooks. There's at least one source who's saying that Apple's been working with McGraw-Hill, a big textbook publisher, since June on this whole program. And there was also a report that one of the biggest publishers in textbooks for higher education is supposed to be at the event as well. A lot of the speculation on what is going to actually be announced is kind of coming out of some of the information that was in Steve Jobs' bio, the Walter Isaacson book. It had a section where he mentioned that he really wanted to shake up textbooks with the iPad. He even had this concept that they'd be able to give them away for free, which would allow states to get past the textbook certification process, which I guess slows the adoption of textbooks and textbooks getting into schools, costs the schools a lot of money, which they don't have right now. So free textbooks would save them money. Not having to go through the certification process would save them money. The thing is that while that sounds great and there's likely some advantages to using iPads over traditional textbooks, I think there's also some new challenges that come into play with that. Specifically on the, you know, if you give textbooks away for free, how do publishers, how do authors make money and stuff like that? So a lot of those unanswered questions, it'll be interesting to see what Apple announces actually at this event on Thursday. I do have some speculation on that I'm going to talk about in a little bit. But I think the number one thing that Apple needs to do is set up something for publishers to give them better tools for creating ebooks. Ars Technica said that this Thursday's announcement will reveal that kind of tool. Apple announcing something that they're calling like GarageBand for ebooks. And I think that's something that's been sorely missing in the publishing side of things. And I hope that's not something that's just available to publishers. I hope that's actually a product that we can all get our hands on, because I think that's going to be a great boon for self-publishers trying to put their stuff into the iBook store. But the announcement is expected to include support for the new EPUB 3 standard, which I guess offers a wider variety of multimedia features, more interactive features that would be ideal for that whole textbook platform. Now, no official hardware is expected to be announced, but there has been a little bit of speculation that Apple might put a 7-inch iPad out there, an education-only iPad that would be lower cost, something that more schools could afford, because that's one of those challenges that I think that you would have with replacing textbooks with iPads. School budgets aren't large. It's very costly. Now, I know books are costly, so you probably could offset. You probably could work it out so that the cost of an iPad is about the same cost as the books. And if you're giving the books away for free, maybe that's some sort of way to subsidize it. Those are the questions that I can't really answer. I can't figure out how Apple would solve that problem. But then you have that whole opposite problem of, are you going to give these to grade school kids who potentially lose them? You might have people who try and sell them. So there are some technical challenges. It'll be interesting to see if Apple addresses any of those issues at this announcement on Thursday. But regardless, there is going to be a big announcement, and we should have some more details by the end of the week. And I think with that, that's all the news I have for you today. Before we move on, I do want to say hello to a new sponsor to the MacCast, and that is Hover. Hover is a domain name registration company, and I've been hearing a lot of really good things about Hover for a while. A lot of my friends in the tech industry, people who deal with having to register a lot of domain names, have told me a lot of really good things about Hover, but I really hadn't tried them yet. And so when they came on as a sponsor, I thought this was a perfect opportunity. You know, I register all my domains with, very large popular registration company, and I've had them there for a long time. So I had a few up for renewal, and I decided, let's try this out. Let's do a domain name transfer. So I did that. And I have to say, everything I had heard turned out to be really true, spot on. It could not have been easier to transfer my domains. It was just $10 to do the transfer, and the first year of registration was included, so affordable. What I really appreciated was the whole experience. Hover has done a really great job of focusing on the user interface, the process of registering your domains and transferring your domains, trying to make that as seamless and as painless as possible. They have a nice, clean interface. They helped me through the process. I've done domain name transfers in the past, and you have to jump through all these hoops. You got to go unlock the domain. You've got to go through these steps and processes. And they had just a little help button through. Well, the first thing that happened was I put in the domain I wanted to transfer. It said it was eligible for transfer, and then it gave me the three steps that I needed to go through to initiate the process. And then within each one of those steps, there was a little help button, and clicking on that, it listed all of the different domain name registers. My current one was there, and they had great screenshots and annotations to show me which parts of the control panel, and believe me, the control panel on my current provider, it's a mess. You know, finding anything there in there is almost impossible. So they put callouts. They showed me exactly where to click, what I needed to change to get through the process, and that really made it easy. And then in addition to that, during my checkout process, I didn't get a lot of heavy upsells or add-on charges. As a matter of fact, domain privacy, which I had always purchased on my domains in the past, that was included in the transfer process, and locking of the domain was built in. So when that was all said and done, got it transferred in just a few minutes, and then I was in the Hover control panel, and that was also a very easy, clean experience. I could set up my domain forwarding. I could set up my DNS, manage all of that stuff, and it was just really, really nice. So the one thing about Hover is they're completely focused on domains. That's all they do. They don't do hosting. They don't do all that extra stuff, which is why you don't get that hard sell. And while they seem like a new company, new to the domain name game, they're actually part of Two Cows. So they've actually been doing domains since the beginning. And right now, if you use the URL hover.com/maccast, you go there, you will automatically get a coupon entered. You'll get 10% off your order. So if you've been thinking about registering a domain or transferring a domain and you want to try a different experience, try Hover, hover.com/maccast. And a big thank you to them for their support of the show. So let's talk a little bit about Apple and Apple's plans for the future. There's been a lot of speculation, a lot of rumors about what Apple's next move is, specifically in the whole media space. Television, I think books, you know, we're seeing that come into play here. And a lot of people have been talking about what Apple is going to be doing. And this week, a piece came out over on Cult of Mac. Mike Elgin did a great piece that summarized a lot of the ideas surrounding what Apple's going to do in the media space. And I share a lot of his thoughts on what Apple's plans are to disrupt the media space. I'm going to have a link to the full article if you want to read through it in the show notes at maccast.com, and I would suggest you do. It's really well written and well done. But, you know, I think it comes down to this. You know, traditionally in the media space, content generation, distribution, and consumption, these are all kinds of separate parts of the chain, and they were managed and controlled by different players, or are managed and controlled by different players. You know, you have the content creators, and then you have the middlemen, the distribution companies, the marketing aspect of that, publishers, movie studios, things like that. And then you have the consumption side of things. That's where us, the consumers, come in, and we buy devices and hardware and software to consume the different media, or we go to a movie theater and buy a ticket, whatever it might be. All of that is controlled by different people, and different people make money throughout that chain. Now, of course, Apple likes to do things differently. And if you look at what they've done in the music space, you know, they set up a system where they get a little bit of each part of that distribution. And it's different. Where they get that from is different depending upon what part of the chain it is, but they make a little profit on all sides. So hardware side on the content creation, software on the content creation side, some of the distribution in terms of iTunes, and then some of the sales of the content. And that content part has become critical to Apple's business with respect to music and books and apps specifically. That little 30% part they get on distributing apps is a big part of where they make some of their money, and that helps drive other parts of their business as well. And so it's all about control of the entire chain from creation to consumption. And I think that's what Apple wants to go after, and that's where they're going to be really the disruptive force in the media industry moving forward. I think music was kind of the beta for Apple, and now they want to go after print and video, specifically TV and movies. And the fight is going to be tougher this time, because I think the movie industry and the book publishing industry is going to be a little more leery about what Apple's up to. And if you remember, with music, it was not an easy road to hoe. So, or road to hoe, is that how you say it? So Apple is going to have their work cut out for them. But I think the ultimate linchpin in Apple cracking all of this is going to be to ultimately remove the middlemen, which I think has kind of been the barrier, and actually not necessarily remove them, but replace them, where Apple becomes the middleman, but maybe a kinder, gentler middleman, just taking their little 30%, making a little bit on the hardware side, making a little bit on the software side, but not really kind of just leeching or sucking off of the content publishers, which it seems in a lot of ways is what's happened with the current industry and the current model. So I think it's a difficult task, but I don't think it's impossible. I think it's something that Apple can do. And we're already starting to see something similar with companies like Netflix and Hulu announcing deals that they are going to start producing and buying original content, making original shows that's distributed just through their networks. And I think that's the game that Apple wants to get into, specifically when it relates to TV and movies. I think podcasting's even done this to a certain degree. You have networks like Revision 3 and Twit making great original content, and they're distributing that directly through Apple and through iTunes, through podcasting, you know, not 100%. Of course, anybody can subscribe to a podcast RSS feed, but you get the point, is a lot of that consumption happens through Apple's channel. And I think on the book side, they're looking to do more with authors and setting up a system where the content creators, the authors, can actually self-publish ebooks. It's already happening to a certain degree, but marketing and distribution, I think, especially in the book space, is still very challenging, and Apple and Amazon are both uniquely positioned to provide a solution for that, and Apple definitely wants a piece of that action. I think the big piece that's missing on the creation side is the tools, the software to be able to put together an ebook, to be able to add all of the advanced features and functionality, and to get that sort of workflow in place. I think on the video side, Apple's already started to take some of the steps so that you can have content creators be able to create really professional stuff. That's Final Cut. Technologies like that allow you to really produce, I think, a higher level quality of content, and now they just have to work on how do we get that content into our channel, and how do we build a channel that's ubiquitous enough and have enough devices and on the consumption side that people can pull down this content. I think the iPad and iOS devices are making great leads and strides in that area, so Apple's got that distribution now. They've got millions of devices out there ready for consumption, and I think the content and distribution of that content is the next hurdle that they need to tackle. And on the book side, it's going to be this new tool, you know, this platform that they can give to book publishers that they can put their content into, they can create their layouts, and then easily push that right into the store. And they've done that already if you look at apps with the Xcode integrated development environment. You can code your Xcode projects. You have an easy way to get your products into channel. Apple helps on the marketing side to a certain degree. It's debatable how much, but you have a way to market your product within Apple's store and get that out to consumers, and you have the devices already out there that they can consume that content on. And I think Apple's going to replicate that model for books, self-published books, and ultimately self-produced and published and distributed TV shows and movies. I think we can really get there, and I think that's where this is going along. The upcoming publishing announcement is probably the first glimpse we're going to see of that strategy as it relates to print publishing. But once again, I think if you look at music, print publishing, and then video production, that is the trend, and Apple's going to be going after all of those spaces. Now, in the Mike Elgin piece, the one place where I differ a little bit on what he's talking about is he mentions a low-cost tablet, a 7-inch tablet like the Kindle Fire, something actually he says, I think, specifically to compete against the Kindle Fire. I don't think Apple is worried about that too much. I think they're happy with the distribution of the iPad, unless maybe it's this educational iPad that is a lower cost thing sold just into the EDU channel, kind of like the eMac was for schools. You know, that education only device, it's a little lower price point, allows you to get more of them into schools and then distribute textbooks through that platform. That might be possible, but I really don't think on the hardware side Apple's going to be going after that. The one part that I think Elgin is really right about, though, is that the first announcement is actually going to include the publishing companies. They're going to be a big part of the announcement that you're going to hear on Thursday. We already talked about McGraw-Hill rumored to be heavily involved in that announcement. But in my opinion, that's a deal with the devil. Those book publishers, they're making a deal with the devil. And in this case, Apple is the devil, because the ultimate end game in all of this is to cut that system out, to totally change that system, change the distribution system, having Apple in the middle and kind of taking a little piece on all sides like they've done and they like to do. And it's really going to disrupt and change those industries. And I think Apple's doing it because those industries haven't been apt to change themselves, yet consumers want something different. And I think publishers and content creators want something different. They want something for the digital age. And Apple's going to pull everybody, whether they like it or not. I think, again, consumers, content creators, and Apple are going to love this. The current old model folks who can't adapt are really going to hate it, and they're going to fight it kicking and screaming, and we're going to see it again just like we saw with the music industry. And I think it's going to, like I said, be an even more bloody battle. But eventually we're going to get there, because I think that's where we're moving. I don't know, maybe I'm completely wrong, but that seems like what's happening. If you have a different thought or opinion, or you want to chime in on this conversation, please send me some feedback, mattcast@gmail.com, and we'll share that out on future episodes. So it's now 2012, and we are in the actual year when Apple will replace its MobileMe service completely with iCloud. MobileMe goes dark on June 30th, and one of the big parts of MobileMe that isn't replaced by anything, at least not on a one-to-one basis in iCloud, is Apple's iDisk. And Sarah, like many of us, has come to rely on Apple's iDisk to keep certain documents and files in sync between her Macs, PCs, and iOS devices. You know, I use Omni Outliner, and as part of that process, they have integration with iDisk, and I transfer my Omni Outliner documents back and forth between my iOS devices using iDisk. I don't know what I'm going to do when iDisk goes away. I guess what I'm hoping is, and I'm pretty sure this is going to happen actually, knowing Omni, that Omni's going to adopt the new replacement in iCloud, which is Documents in the Cloud. But Documents in the Cloud, at least right now, at best, is kind of a pseudo-substitute for iDisk. It doesn't have the third-party integration. So until those third-party application developers adopt the Documents in the Cloud model, it's really not going to work very well. I mean, Apple themselves has not even adopted that with iWork on the desktop. It doesn't fully integrate with Documents in the Cloud. I expect that we're going to see an update to iWork on the desktop, and it will bring that, but not really a replacement. And for those of us who are looking for something right now, we're going to have to try and find something different. So the key to all this, I think, is an integrated cloud-based document solution that works across all of your platforms, Mac, Windows, and iOS. And right now, if you were to put me up to the wall and ask me what's the best product for that, I think the best solution we have at the moment is Dropbox. And that's why so many of us are Dropbox fans, including myself. In many ways, I think it's better than what iCloud offers, because it already has tight integration with a ton of apps. They've done a great job of getting their APIs out there and making them available to developers, and developers have responded by integrating that. And that's something that Apple's going to really have to work on in this next year with Documents in the Cloud if they want to get a lot of us to switch away from a service like Dropbox. I was actually really hoping that Apple would have just purchased Dropbox, and we heard those rumors that they tried, but were unsuccessful, and I'm kind of sad that that didn't happen. But it would have been great if Dropbox was just integrated into Mac OS X and into iOS, and I think that would have solved a lot of this problem. But the key is this seamless syncing and also versioning of your documents. That's another feature that Dropbox has that isn't really built in, as far as I know, into Documents in the Cloud. I guess it's kind of built into the operating system itself, but I don't think I can go in my iOS device and roll back to a different version, or go into the web interface and roll back to a different version of a document that I've stored in Documents in the Cloud. You can do that with Dropbox. And the other big difference with Dropbox is that your documents sit up there in the cloud, and they're not necessarily synced. Documents in the Cloud, as far as I understand it, or my grokking of it, is that you save a document on one device, it's automatically pushed up into Documents in the Cloud and then synced back down, or pushed back down onto your other devices. I'm not entirely convinced it works 100% that way on iOS. I think actually what happens is if I save an iWork document on my iPad and then save that into Documents in the Cloud, when I open the iWork application on my iPhone, on my iOS device, it goes out to the Documents in the Cloud server, sees that there's a new file there, and at that point pulls it down. I don't think it's a true push. I think it's more of a pseudo push where it pulls it down. But it still syncs all of those documents to all of your devices, and that takes up space. Dropbox is a little bit different because you actually go reach out to the Dropbox server. You can see everything that you've stored there, on iOS at least, and then just pull it down if you need it. And You can either do that through apps that have the integration built in, or you can use Dropbox's own app on iOS and then use the open-in feature. So I can go through, I can browse all of my documents that are up on Dropbox and then simply select them and then send them to an application within my iOS device using that open-in option through the little action button on the app. And it works great. It is just so quick, so easy. And then on the desktop, everything just syncs. And everything stays in sync. So anything I save into my Dropbox folder on my Mac automatically goes up in Dropbox on the cloud and then is made available to any of my iOS devices when I need to get a document. So it's something that just works, and it's integrated with so many apps, and that's the key. The one thing about Dropbox is you don't get quite as much storage for free. You get 2 gigabytes for free versus the 5 gigabytes that iCloud will give you. But you can always buy more for $99 a year with Dropbox. You can get up to 50 gigabytes of storage. And I think that's somewhat in line with the paid pricing if you need more storage on iCloud. And, you know, it's a great way to go. So, Sarah, if you're looking for something now, look into Dropbox if you don't have it already. I thought I'd also give some honorable mentions in terms of other ways that you can store documents in the cloud and access them on your iOS devices. One might be your online backup service. So if you have online backup, a lot of them have applications that will allow you to access your backup data. Specifically, I use CrashPlan, and they have a great application on iOS. I can launch my CrashPlan application and access anything that I backed up through CrashPlan onto their servers on my iOS devices. And that's been particularly handy. Because I don't store everything in Dropbox, and occasionally there'll be that one file that's in my documents folder, in my home folder, that I want to get access to on an iOS device, and I can get that through CrashPlan. So that's a way to go. And then also, you can kind of round-trip stuff if you're not actually syncing it through Dropbox or you don't have Dropbox integration in your application. You might be able to round trip it through another application, and I'm finding that I do this a little more frequently now that I kind of realize this little trick, and that is find an application. Something like Goodreader is a good example of this. Goodreader has Dropbox integration. It has support for lots of different file types, so I can actually open up Goodreader, go to the Dropbox area, grab any file I need out of my Dropbox, put it into Goodreader, and then again, use that open in feature through the action menu to actually send it off to another application. And then if I need to get it back into Dropbox, I can send it back to Goodreader and then push it back up into Dropbox and do a whole back and forth that way. Not quite as seamless as, say, maybe just iDisk integration or direct Dropbox integration, but it works in a pinch. And you can get the job done. And until Apple does something more with documents in the cloud and it's more integrated with our applications, I think that's the kind of stuff that we're going to have to do. So that's what I would do. And thanks for the question. So believe it or not, the last two items I have for you this week are somewhat Windows related. Although this first one is more about mail and attachments and just kind of getting attachments back and forth between Mac and Windows. Ian was having some issues where suddenly attachments that he was sending from Apple Mail to some clients, to some coworkers, I think, on Exchange Server were no longer getting through. Specifically, I think he was trying to send some PDFs. And I guess there's a known issue with PDF attachments sent from Apple Mail to a Microsoft Exchange Server 2007 with the roll-up update 3 for Microsoft Exchange Server 2007 Service Pack 3 to a Microsoft Outlook 2010 client. So there's a real specific chain here. What is up with Microsoft and their naming of their updates? The update roll-up 3 for Microsoft Exchange Server 2007 Service Pack 3. Give me a break. Can we simplify that a little bit? Anyway, I digress. But very specific issue, and it's possibly what was happening in your case, Ian, that your maybe IT department, because it was working, I guess, a few days ago and then just suddenly stopped working. It's possible IT went in and applied this roll-up update, and there's actually a fix for it. I'll send you a link to a TechInfo article on Microsoft's site that explains how to apply the patch or the fix for this, and that will hopefully clear up your issue. But it does bring up the bigger conversation of just mail attachments and opening mail attachments and some tips and tricks for making that process a little more seamless. A lot of us, you know, we have to send files and email attachments to users on other systems, be it Linux, be it Unix. You know, not everybody uses a Mac as much as we'd like them all to, I think, and make all of our lives a lot simpler. But we do have to be good citizens, be good network internet citizens, and share those files. And very often you'll send an attachment to somebody and they'll write you back and say, oh, I didn't get it, or I couldn't open it, or I don't see it. And I think a lot of times some of the confusion is just simply user error. I mean, different clients, web-based clients versus desktop clients, just work differently with how they handle and access attachments. And that can be sometimes difficult to work through. So sometimes you have to just do some Googling and figure out what the right button to click on is. You know, just ask the person, hey, what is your mail client? What version are you using? And you have to do a little tech support. You know, it's not always the funnest thing to do, but we do it from time to time. But the other thing to note is that if you're using mail.app, there are some built-in features that can maybe make the whole process go a little bit smoother. One thing that mail.app does by default is it tries to, for any file formats that it can display inline, it tries to display them inline. So that would be things like PDFs and images. Not all mail clients, though, really support that very well. So one of the things that can happen is you can send a file to somebody and they're looking for an attachment, specifically an image. I've had this happen quite frequently with like JPEGs or something like that. You send them the document and they go, well, I can view it, you know, I can see it in the mail application, but I don't see a way to save it out. And very often the answer is just, you know what, just click it, drag it out to your desktop on Windows, and that actually works. So you can drag it out of the mail window. The other thing you can do is, you know, tell them to look for the little paperclip icon or some sort of save option under their file menu. You know, it's really easy if you're on a Mac, because you can just drag it out of the window. You can click on the a file and click on the save button in the main reading window, and that will automatically save it to the default downloads folder. Or you can click on the save button, the little triangle that'll give you the drop down, and select the save all option, and that'll give you the standard save dialog box and allow you to save it to a specific location. And that's the same thing as going under the file menu in mail and choosing save attachments. Interesting thing on that save all thing is, even if you only have one attachment, if you want to save it to a specific folder, not just the default downloads folder, you have to use that save all option, and then you can get that standard dialog window. Now, on Windows, it may be totally different. How those things are handled could be very different, and images may or may not end up in line depending upon the settings that the person has. I was playing around with this a little bit. I tried it out in Outlook Express 6, which is the default client on Windows XP. I'm not sure about Windows 7. Attachments and other images did not show up. Well, images showed up in line, but things like PDFs or other attachments did not show up in the body of the email. So I sent them in mail.app. They were in the body of the email when I sent it, but on the receiving side, they didn't show up there. And this is where some of this confusion comes into play. So there was a little paperclip icon, and then I could click on that, and then I could see the attachments in the, you know, in the preview window, and I could save them off. Now, if I double-clicked and I actually opened up that mail message, the interface changed again, and the attachments actually appeared up in the header area under attachments, and then I could drag them out from there or save them out from that location. So this is the kind of thing where you're going to have to figure out how the receiving client handles these different types of attachments. But then also within mail.app, there are some things that you can probably do that'll help out on the Windows side. One of the big ones is file extensions. So just in your file naming in Mac OS X, make sure that you save your files with dot extensions, especially if you know you're going to be attaching them to email and sending them off to Windows users, because Windows really relies on those files file extensions to figure out how to open things. Or it hasn't traditionally in the past. Probably newer versions handle this a little bit better, but still you run into it. So in OS X, you can actually confirm if your file names have extensions by taking a look at your Finder preferences. And depending upon how it's set, you may or may not see file extensions. Or you may be seeing file extensions, but they're being applied to your file names by Mac OS X, and they're not actually on the file names. So if you go into the Finder preferences and you go under Advanced, you'll see there's a little checkbox that says Show All File Name Extensions. If you have that checked on, even if you don't add a file extension to your file names, it will try and add it, or it'll just display it automatically, I guess is the more accurate thing to say. So it'll show the dot extension, but it's not actually going to be in the file name. So you want to make sure that is unchecked and then check the file name. If it doesn't have the dot extension, so let's take a JPEG image, for example. If it doesn't say .jpg or .jpeg, you'll want to add that to the file name before you attach it to your email and send it off. Now, something somewhat related to the JPEG issue is my wife had a situation where she was trying to send some photos to a friend. She was receiving them, but they weren't coming across as attachments, and it was very confusing to her. And what we discovered was that if the file extension was set to .jpeg, she couldn't, for some reason, see the image files. But if we just changed it to .jpeg, the four-letter extension, then they worked. Why? I have no idea, but that's the kind of troubleshooting that you might have to do when you're dealing with mail and attachment issues. Some other things that you can do within mail.app is, one, when you're adding attachments, make sure that in the open dialog window down there at the bottom, so when you click the little paperclip to add an attachment, you will see down at the bottom of the window a checkbox that says send Windows-friendly attachments. Make sure that's checked on if you know you're sending to a Windows user. That can help. Another thing that can cause issues sometimes is mail.app by default will allow you to put attachments anywhere within your message. So you can put them in line right in the middle of your message. You've probably seen this. When you drag in an attachment, it kind of goes in where your insertion point was at any given moment, or you can actually drag it into a specific part of a message and it kind of sticks there. You'll either get the icon, or if it's something that it can preview, you'll get the preview of that attachment right in line at the position that you dropped it. Well, that's not always copacetic or isn't always compatible with receiving mail clients. A lot of those want to have the attachments at the end of the message, and there's actually a setting for that. You can go under the Edit menu under Attachments, and you'll see an option that says Insert Attachments at the end of the message. You need to turn that on before you add your attachments, and once you've done that, when you drag them in, it'll automatically put those attachments at the end of your message. And Apple actually has a support article that says in OS 10.5 and 10.6, if you don't send with attachments at the end to an Exchange server, the attachments can, on the receiving side, are often unable to be opened. So you're going to want to turn that on, especially if you know you're sending it to someone who's on Exchange server. And unfortunately, you do have to turn that on for each message that you compose. It doesn't stick, so just be aware of that. There is actually a terminal plist hack that you can use to turn it on permanently, but in doing my research for that, there appears to be some issues. Specifically, if you turn this feature on, you can't attach V cards. So if that's the kind of thing that you do, just be aware of that. I will have the command in the show notes at maccast.com if you want to know what it is and you want to turn it on. But just be aware that it can cause some funkiness with attaching things in mail. And then the last thing that you can play around with is if you have added attachments and they are displaying inline, specifically images or PDFs, then you can right-click or control-click on those, and you'll see an option that says Show as Icon. So you can toggle it between the inline preview or the icon view of that attachment. Now, you'll see that in mail, but sometimes even after you send it, it may get processed differently on the receiving side. So depending upon the person's mail client, it may turn that back into an inline image. regardless of the fact that you told it to show as an icon before you sent it. But play around with those, and that might help things. Now, you can, if none of this works, so if you go through all these different tricks and it's still not working, you're sending the attachment to somebody and they're saying, I still can't see the attachment, I can't save it. If all else fails, kind of the one thing that always seems to work for me is creating a zip file. Just putting all of your attachments, or even if it's just one attachment, converting it into a zip and attaching it to your email. And that way, on the receiving side, it almost always comes through. It's a little more work, and the person's going to have to go through the extra step of unzipping that file. But both Mac OS X and Windows handle zip files natively really well. It used to be a problem where you'd have to download additional software in the past, but that's all gone. So just make a zip file and then attach that. It's really easy to do in Mac OS X. Just go into the Finder, select the items that you want to put into the archive. You can even do the multiple selections, and then control or right click on your selection and choose the compress option. And that will create an archive.zip. You can rename that and then attach that to your email. You can also just throw everything into a folder that you want to put into the zip archive and do the same thing. Control right click on it, choose the compress option, and that will create the zip. And then that's the thing that you drag into your mail message to send. And then the last thing, as I was kind of doing the research for this, there actually is a mail add-on. I can't vouch for it, but there's a program called Attachment Tamer from Lokiware, and they claim that their software addresses a number of these cross-client issues when you're adding attachments to mail. According to their website, it'll do things like display and print images, PDF, audio and video files as icons with optional file size limits and exceptions. It'll send messages compatible with Microsoft Outlook, Exchange, and other software, preventing the superfluous ATT00001 attachments. I'm not sure what that is, but if you've ever seen those, or if people on the receiving side have seen those in messages coming from you, I guess it'll take care of that. Send images as regular attachments, making it easier for the recipient to manipulate the image files. Send images embedded in HTML layout and safely mix and embed images with other attachments. Display full attachment names regardless of the length instead of truncated names, and prevent unwanted image resizing, or set a default image size for automatic image resizing. So Apple kind of has those presets where you can reset images. It sounds like you get a little more flexibility with the attachment tamer thing. And I think you can also, with this, set the option to always have your attachments come across as icons rather than displaying inline. So if any of you have used this software, the Attachment Tamer, and found it to be useful, I think it runs about $15. Let us know if it actually works. I did not try it out. I haven't played around with it, but it might be something worth looking into if you've been running into mail attachment problems. So I hope that helps you out, Ian. I think I covered a lot more than I thought I would on this one, but it is an issue that crops up from time to time. And then lastly for today, I want to talk about a cool piece of software that came out this week for running Windows on your iPad. Yeah, I said running Windows on your iPad. Well, not really running it on the iPad, but in a way, OnLive released their OnLive desktop for iPad. And if you don't know who OnLive is, OnLive is a company. They've been mainly focused on bringing gaming to set-top box. And the way they do it is they have virtualized gaming environments that are on a server, and then they just stream pretty much a video stream to your display, to your device, and then all of the action, the software, everything running happens on the server side, and then you're just seeing this kind of virtualized environment. And now they've released a virtualized Windows environment for the iPad. It's called OnLive Desktop. It's totally free, and basically you get a Windows 7 desktop environment set up on their servers. You get 2 gigabytes of storage space for free, and you get access to the Microsoft Office applications, Word, Excel, and PowerPoint. And it's version 10 of those applications. And then they layer on touch controls and ink support, which is the handwriting to text recognition. So you can actually be working on a Word document. You can handwrite on your iPad and it'll convert that to text. But it's happening all virtually over on a server, and you're just kind of interacting on the iPad with a video stream of what's going on the server, kind of like remote access, VNC, that sort of thing. That's what's going on. Or if you have Parallels or VMware, they have iPad applications that now work with, you know, your Mac or your on your LAN. This is happening over the internet through the OnLive application. And they've layered on the Microsoft Touch Pack for Windows 7. I think that's what Windows uses for tablet PCs right now to be able to add touch controls. And it works surprisingly well. Also on the software side, they are able to stream video. So it has Windows Media Player, Sticky Notes, Windows Journal. There's some additional Microsoft Surface touch kind of applications, including some games that you can play. It does have to work over the internet. So depending upon your internet connection, that can affect things. I had a couple situations where it did kind of conk out on me and I got some error messages. But overall, I was very impressed with how well it actually did work. I was able to get in there, work on a Microsoft Word document, save that out to my documents folder. And then as far as how you access those documents on the desktop, if you wanted to be able to pull that down and maybe open it up in Pages or work with it on your Mac, right now you have to go through a web interface through the OnLive website. But, you know, that's really not any different than how you have to work with documents in the cloud on iWork right now. And OnLive did say that they're planning on bringing a Mac Windows client, putting out a Mac and a Windows client, so you'll be able to actually run the software on the desktop. And also they're going to have it available for Android devices and TV. So worth checking out if you have a need to occasionally open up a Windows file, a Word document or a PowerPoint or something like that, and you don't want to shell out the money for a copy of Windows and something like VMware or Parallels. This is totally free and lets you do it, and it works on your iPad. So I thought it was cool, and I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. And with that, that's going to do it for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Furonix, makers of Deep Freeze. You can check out their software, get more information and details over at furonix.com. Circus Ponies, check out Notebook. They have free trials available. You can get information as well as those demos over at circusponies.com. Smile, check out Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label. Get more information and details over at smilesoftware.com. And if you're planning on registering a new domain, or you have a domain that you'd like to transfer, you want a little bit better domain name experience, check out Hover and use the URL hover.com/maccast to save 10%. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the Maccast. Big thank you to you for your support, for staying subscribed, for listening. Hey, if you have any questions for me, any comments, anything you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, please send your emails, your audio comments to maccast@gmail.com, or you can call in on the voicemail line. That telephone number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9, and you can leave voicemail message there. You can also leave voicemail on Skype. My Skype name is The MacCast. And be sure to check out the maccast.com website. There you'll find show notes and links to anything that I talked about in this or any other episode of the MacCast. And while you're there, be sure to check out the MacCast forum. That's at forum.maccast.com. And you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast, or over on Facebook, facebook.com/themaccast. That's all I got. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.